Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, January 8, 2018, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon's topic will be on the Nevada recall election lawsuit. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Christian Adams, who is President and General Counsel at the Public Interest Legal Foundation. Christian will give his remarks right now, and then we'll eventually move to an audience Q&A. Thank you for joining us, Christian. The floor is now yours.
Thank you for having me, and thanks, everybody, for joining the teleforum involving a relatively fascinating issue out of what might seemingly be a quirky local issue. And what we're talking about is the case of Luna versus Sagovsky. And apologies if I mispronounce that, but Secretary of State of Nevada even campaigns on her name being just Barbara because of its difficult pronunciation. But nonetheless, this is an election law case, and it is a challenge to Nevada's recall elections. And what the context that led to this case is a challenge to three state senators. Control in the Nevada State Senate is very, very close. And ultimately, the outcome of these recall elections would have the potential to flip control of the Nevada Senate from Democrat to Republican. So recall efforts were made in Nevada targeting three particular Senate districts. Under the Nevada Constitution, state law specifically authorizes a recall of any public officer if you file a notice of intent to recall, along with a petition signed by 25% of the voters who voted in the preceding election. So in other words, if you want to recall any public official in Nevada, the state law allows you to do that by filing first a notice and then getting a quarter of the people who voted in the previous election to sign on to it. So it's a fairly, it encourages recalls, you might say. But nonetheless, it is the Nevada law. And it's the law at issue in this case. So the notice of intent to recall was filed, and currently there's a state proceeding involving the adequacy and sufficiency and eligibility of the signatures involved. And I'm not going to talk about the state proceeding today except to mention that it is occurring. What this teleform is about is the federal case that has been filed, Luna versus Sagovsky, in an effort to block the recall. And the reason that the case is important is because it makes a variety of federal statutory claims that, in my view, are rather novel, but more importantly, bear notice because they implicate election laws nationwide. And what we have by the plaintiffs in this case, who are a number of voters from each of these Senate districts, in the case which is brought by the law firm of Perkins Coie, which has brought a number of similar cases around the country. So this is not an isolated jurisprudential strategy. This is taking place. The same arguments are being made against voter identification laws, against a variety of other election process laws around the country by the same law firm. And so far, These efforts have not met with a great deal of success, but here we are in Nevada. What are the unique and novel claims being made? The plaintiff in this case in Nevada is arguing that the existence of a recall, a law that allows you to have a recall election in this case, is a violation of the Voting Rights Act, because having a recall election is racially discriminatory. And where they get to this conclusion is largely, it's in the complaint, but you can read in the complaint where they say things such as the informational costs of learning the details of a special election, the time each voter must spend to protect their already cast vote, the economic burden of needing to be excused from work or school, the need to obtain transportation to the polling place, the need to stay on top of the issues in a recall election. All of these things have a racially discriminatory impact on minority voters. So if a similarly situated white voter and a similarly situated black voter are forced to go to vote twice that they didn't expect to do when they voted in November, then it has a racially disparate impact on the minority voters. And so they allege that the recall election procedures are a violation of the Federal Voting Rights Act under Section 2. Now, this, as far as I can tell, is the first time that a recall election, a state recall election, has been subject to this sort of challenge. Normally, these fights are in the area of signature challenges and so forth, but this is part of a larger nationwide litigation strategy to use arguments that a given election procedure that one party doesn't like is somehow racially discriminatory, largely through a statistical analysis, disparate impacts. No claim, by the way, that minorities or language minorities cannot vote in a recall election, but rather that it's just more difficult for them to vote because of socioeconomic conditions. For example, here's from the complaint, paragraph 40. It says the costs of voting are already substantially higher for low-income voters who are less likely to own homes and more frequently move from one residence to another. So this sort of legal philosophy can be found throughout the complaint. Other allegations, like in paragraph 42, that say disparities in educational attainment make it more difficult for minority voters to overcome the heightened informational barriers to voting in an off-cycle special election, which garners less public attention, for which there may be more limited resources for voter outreach than in general elections. So what the plaintiff is essentially arguing, that the unique nature of the recall violates federal civil rights statutes. The posture of the case, as it stands right now, is there is essentially a stay of sorts, where the, frankly, it almost is a ripeness argument that hasn't been made. There's a stay of sorts waiting for the outcome of the state certification procedures. In other words, let's sit back, is the federal court's attitude, and see if, in fact, the signatures are adequate and sufficient to move forward with the election. My organization, the Public Interest Legal Foundation, intervened successfully right now in the case to act as defendant interveners to assist the state of Nevada in developing a number of arguments that the state of Nevada is not making as a defense. Among them are the fact, or is the argument, that the plaintiff's reliance on the language minority provisions of the Voting Rights Act under Section 2 is unconstitutional in this instance. In other words, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act has a language minority provision, not just race, but protects language minorities. This was passed in 1975 as an amendment to the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And the defense that we're raising is that the language minority provisions cannot be extended to strike down a state recall election and adhere to constitutional limits under the 15th Amendment, the enforcement power of the 15th Amendment, that if a court were to do that, they would be going beyond the constitutional enforcement power of the 15th Amendment and utilizing language minority provisions to strike down a state constitutional state recall election. We're also alleging in our defense, again, a defense that the state is not making, that the language minority provisions of the 1975 amendments are facially unconstitutional, that Congress has the power to legislate against racial discrimination, but whether or not you can speak English is not within the scope of the 15th Amendment's bundle of protections. That is not race. That is something else. It is not within Congress's power to upset the Federalist balance regarding election control based on language minority status. Now, when I refer to the Federalist balance, what am I referring to? I'm talking about the fact that states are given power under the Constitution to run their own elections. This is the presumption of the Constitution that states have power over their own elections, absent a number of enumerated exceptions, such as, of course, the 15th Amendment's prohibition on racial discrimination. But whether or not a state recall election can be invalidated because it violates the language minority provisions of Section 2, we're arguing in our intervention defense that is a facially unconstitutional provision. Because in 1975, Congress exceeded its authority to enforce the 15th Amendment when it extended it to your ability to speak English or not, as opposed to racial discrimination. Lastly, and before we open it up for questions, of course, the plaintiffs make some other arguments. They claim that it's an undue burden under the Anderson Burdick test, the 14th Amendment. They claim that it violates the First Amendment to have to require people to essentially vote twice. So you can see that rather than being a quirky little Nevada election law dispute, that this lawsuit, which, by the way, I have the number for you here. It's in Nevada. It's case number 217-2666. That this case is actually an effort to constitutionalize, if you will, what some would say are partisan efforts to both invalidate an election, but also to oppose that invalidation. In other words, that partisan interests have utilized constitutional arguments to affect a political outcome, and whether or not the Voting Rights Act was meant to be extended in that way is an open question, I think, for courts. It's a question that came up in the North Carolina voter ID and election integrity litigation. It came up in the Virginia voter ID litigation. The same battle of attempting to constitutionalize and turn basic election process issues into civil rights and racial discrimination issues is one that's not just taking place in Nevada, but is taking place across the country. And it has profound implications because it would allow federal courts, if successful, to really upset the balance that the founders envisioned for who should control their own elections. The founders wanted the states to control their own elections. In 1868, obviously, there was a new provision of the Constitution that made an exception to that general rule if it involved racial discrimination. There's been some other ones, presidential elections for 18-year-olds and so forth, and for women, gender discrimination in elections for president and so forth. But the balance and the presumptions remain intact. The states are still presumed to run their own elections. And so you have one side that's attempting to extend federal power, and the state of Nevada, our group, other groups in this area are attempting to oppose this expansion of federal power over state elections. So with that, I will turn it over to any questions. I appreciate all the time that you have devoted to listening to me, and I'm opening up for questions now.
Thank you, Christian. Let's go ahead and move to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone. While we wait for our audience queue to build, Christian, you'd already touched on this in your remarks, but would you mind commenting for the audience just on, while this is a case happening in Nevada, where are we seeing this around the nation?
Right. I think it was most obvious in the Virginia voter ID case. The same law firm, Perkins Coie, which, for those of you who don't know the firm, this is, some call it Hillary's law firm, but Mark Elias is a very good election lawyer who represents Hillary Clinton's campaign and other Democratic party campaigns. And he has essentially developed this theory that Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act can be used to invalidate state election laws which have, in his view, a detrimental impact on his partisan clients. And so we saw it starkly in the Virginia voter ID case, but the court, in the district court opinion, and it was upheld by the Fourth Circuit, I think Judge Shedd wrote the opinion, which, for those of you who know the Fourth Circuit, should tell you what the opinion looks like, which has largely rejected, at least in the Virginia voter ID case, this effort to turn Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act into a partisan weapon. I actually have a Law Review article, I don't have it in front of me, but it's called Transformation, Turning Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act into Something It Is Not, that discusses this in far greater detail for those of you looking for really down-in-the-weeds analysis.
Thank you, Christian. Looks like we do have one question in the queue. If you'd like to ask a question, enter the star key then the pound key on your telephone. Let's move to our first audience question.
Hi, Christian. This is Roger Clegg with the Center for Equal Opportunity, and thank you very much for that great presentation and for the good work you're doing in Nevada and elsewhere. I wanted to ask you to elaborate a little bit on Section 2. I heard you just say that you didn't want to get into the weeds too much, but I'm going to try to drag you in just
thanks,
a little
Roger.
Bit. For you know those who may be new to this area, everybody recognizes that Section 2 at least makes it illegal to engage in intentional racial discrimination, as does the Constitution itself. But when the Supreme Court ruled in 1980 that the old version of Section 2 was coextensive with the Constitution, that is, that it didn't make anything illegal that wasn't also unconstitutional, and that therefore you had to show intentional discrimination in order to show a Section 2 violation, Congress overturned that with the new language in Section 2. The problem is that it's very hard to figure out exactly what Congress meant to do in Section 2. As you say, it seems unlikely that it simply intended to enact a straight disparate impact ban. There are just simply too many things that inevitably are going to have disproportionate racial effects. But on the other hand, it does seem pretty clear that they intended to make some things illegal under Section 2 that are not also unconstitutional. So could you elaborate on where you think the line should be drawn between between acts that are violations of Section 2? I mean, what does Section 2 make illegal that the Constitution doesn't?
Right, and Roger, this is one of the, you're right. This is a complicated question, but let me sum up real quick. I think real world causality is the touchstone that I use. In other words, a state election practice must have real world causality in impairing minority voting rights. Now, that doesn't mean vote denial necessarily. There could still be dilution with real-world causality, and I talk about this in the Law Review article, which is called Transformation, and that is, let's take voter ID. Is there real-world causality that prevents minorities from going to the polls, even if it is not not the exact, it's not a vote denial claim, but can they go get ID? Is there real world causality? I think, and the reason I say this is because if you look at the Supreme Court opinion Jingles, which is really the first and most important decision relating to Section 2 from the Supreme Court, is Jingles 3, and again, this is getting in the weeds, but Jingles 3 focuses on real-world causality. Are minorities losing elections, largely at-large elections in the context of Jingles, in context of districting, I should say, are minorities losing elections because Jingles 1 satisfied, Jingles 2 satisfied, and the Senate factors that they discuss are basically met? Are they actually losing because you have at-large districts as opposed to single-member districts? And Jingles 3 laser focuses in on doing a statistical analysis of real-world causality. And so I think you have to have real-world causality, where minorities are losing or somehow being impaired in their interest in a real way, is what bridges the gap between the pre-1982 world and the post-1982 world, and allows you to not make Section 2 a disparate impact law. So in the case of Nevada that we talked about, nobody's really being impaired from voting. I mean, that's the real problem the plaintiffs had, just like they have the same problem in the voter ID cases, that it's almost impossible to find somebody who can't get voter ID. But, you know, it's not always impossible to find people who lose at-large elections, and I've done it. And when we've had the Georgetown County case, the school board case there, Lake Park, Florida, there are candidates who are losing at-large elections in large measure because of their race. And so I think that that's probably how you bridge the very complicated gap between the two.
Thank you very much, Christian. And, you know, thanks again for your good work, Nevada and elsewhere. And I'm going to make a plug also for a paper that our mutual friend Hans von Spakovsky and I did for Heritage, the Heritage Foundation, on the issue of Section 2 and disparate impact. And people can look that up as well. And I think, you know, you're quite right to say that, you know, there simply has to be some limiting principle here. Otherwise, Section 2 is going to be used simply as a partisan weapon.
And let me plug that paper you just mentioned, and I'll tell you why it's so important. And folks need to understand this. Jingles 2 involves polarization coefficients. How much does one race vote one way and one race vote the other? Do they split their votes, or they act like a herd, a block? And Jingles 2 addresses that issue. Why is that important? Because black cohesion coefficients in the last 10 years have skyrocketed. They're up around 95, 94, 96, 97%, both in national and local elections. And as soon as voting behavior among African Americans reaches those levels of cohesion, the Voting Rights Act essentially becomes a partisan weapon if you accept the principle of disparate impacts theory. And that's the danger, and that's, of course, what the plaintiffs are trying to do. So if cohesion levels are that high and the law is a disparate impacts law, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 is no longer being used to protect against racial discrimination, but rather being used to advance Democratic Party interests.
Thank you, Roger, for your question. Let's move to the next audience question.
This is David Burge in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm sitting here in what used to be a Section 5 state, and given that that section is at least tabled for the time being, I'm wondering if some of these theories that you're talking about are trying to be developed for potential challenges to the redistricting that we will have coming up in the next 2 to 3 years, and to have some of these redistricting challenged under Section 2. Instead of under Section 5, which is what we in the South are used to.
David, I'm so glad you brought up Section 5, because I probably neglected to do it in my presentation. You are spot on. If you were listening and you heard the description of the disparate impact theory, that any, you know, disparate harm against a particular racial minority group triggers Section 2 liability, you probably recognize the terminology. And the terminology was essentially borrowed from Section 5, which is, you know, the preclearance provisions that affected 16 states until Shelby v. Holder. And it basically is a hair trigger. It's a, you know, there's an ever so slight of an impact against racial minorities, and therefore the law is invalid. Now, the difference is the burden shift. There's no burden shift, at least not yet. Maybe that'll be the next complaint, but there's no burden shift. In other words, defendants don't have to prove their innocence. Rather, plaintiffs under Section 2 must prove their liability. So you're exactly right. And if you read the Law Review article that I talked about, transformation, turning Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act into something it is not, I get into the origins of this insofar as the Justice Department, when I was there, had a very, closed door and relatively secretive. I explain how secretive it was to the extent that the voting section chief didn't even know about it, developing a post-Shelby strategy. And I suggest, and so does a source in my article that I quote at length, suggests that this new theory of Section 2 emerged out of what are we going to do if the Supreme Court strikes down the preclearance obligations in Shelby v. Holder. And no sooner had they done that, the Supreme Court had done that, that these cases started getting filed around the country, trying to essentially turn Section 2 into Section 5, hence the title of my Law Review article, Transformation. And that's exactly what I think is happening, David. So it's a great question, and thanks for asking it.
Thank you. Let's move to our next audience question.
Hey, Christian. It's Jack Park, and thank you. I echo Roger and David's thanks. You referred to the Senate factors in your discussion, and those come from a 1982 congressional hearing or congressional legislative report, and they were incorporated into Thornburg v. Gingles in 1986, and we're 30 years after the fact. How long are we going to have to put up with those factors, given that one would think that we're making progress on a lot of these things? Will we ever make enough progress to jettison that whole inquiry?
Jack, that's a great question, and it's even worse than you suggest, because these things kind of just got grafted into the law that, and you know, they were never passed by Congress, but yet they have become, I mean, look at any of the complaints that get filed in Section 2 regarding redistricting, and every single one of them, you know, will cite this. And one thing I want to point out for those of you who are defending these sorts of cases, one of the things I like to evangelize is use the Senate factors in your favor. In other words, develop countervailing evidence of like responsiveness and, you know, official discrimination. Well, look, we go out of our way to not officially discriminate. And that's something that I think defendants have not in the past, at least in cases where I was a plaintiff, have not been really even thinking about. So you're right, Jack. This is a strange thing. And if you haven't seen the Senate factors, check them out. Like things like slating. If you have slating, it can weigh against the defendant. And it's not even the defendant's slating. It's just slating as it exists in the natural environment. My favorite is racial appeals. Yeah, racial appeals in campaigns. Well, you know, it's not the defendant making the racial appeal, but if the racial appeal exists, it contributes to polarization, and therefore it's something that sort of aggravates the situation and makes it easier for plaintiffs to win a case. Look, I don't think Congress is ever going to touch these things, certainly not this Congress. I almost don't want them to, in a way, because, you know, this is such a weird niche area that, you know, try to explain how to deal with the Senate factors. But I think you have a great point that socioeconomic conditions, look at what's happening around the country to a growing black middle class since the Senate factors were passed. Look at the Internet. I mean, you know, educational limits, everybody's walking around with a phone. I mean, information's at your fingertips. So I think there's a lot of cultural and societal changes that have taken place since 1986 that really call into question the viability of the Senate factors as they were constituted 20 years ago. But more importantly, maybe some defendants will start to press the argument that they aren't quite as important as they were when they were decided to be relevant in 1986.
Thanks, Christian.
Thank you, Jack. It looks like we do have a couple more questions in the queue. If it's okay with you, Christian, we'll go ahead
Great.
And move to them.
All righty.
Christian, this is a little bit off topic but still related, and that's the with respect to the recent dissolution of the voter registration panel. Just wondered if you had any thoughts on that, why it happened, and how it was that the states got away with not responding to the requests for public information about registration of voters.
Well, indeed, I'm not sure what to say. I mean, I have a statement that is posted at Election Law Center. I have an article that I'm working on with somebody that should be in the newspaper tomorrow about this. It's unfortunate. It's also not surprising, considering the commission had people on it who were dedicated to sabotaging the work of the commission. But again, that's a bit far afield from our discussion of Nevada. So I'd direct you to the Washington Examiner in the next couple of days.
Thank you.
Thank you for your question. Let's move to another audience question.
Hi, Christian. This is Linda Kearns from Philadelphia.
Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Yes. Christian, I'm wondering if any of the organizations that purport to represent minorities and the disadvantaged have picked up on the fact that these plaintiffs are being portrayed in a way that is offensive and patronizing and insulting, and really as second-class citizens, completely incapable of making their own voting decisions. And I'm asking this especially in light of what you just said about, you know, that now we have the widespread dissemination of information via cell phones, and it's really available to everybody.
You know, you would think that the answer to that would be yes. The civil rights groups and so forth, the usual folks, are very offended by this. But I will tell you, Linda, if all you need to do is look at the North Carolina voter ID litigation, I think it was Charles Stewart from MIT. I might be wrong about that, but I think it was him. He wrote an expert report and provided testimony that the plaintiffs put up, right? The civil rights groups themselves hired an expert that said black voters were, quote, less sophisticated. That's literally his terminology. I think it was Charles Stewart. I reserve the right to be wrong about that. I wrote an article about it when it happened. That black voters are less sophisticated, therefore they don't know how to get voter ID. And it might have been the Texas case also, where you had similar expert testimony from civil rights groups experts saying that minorities were not capable of navigating the normal procedures of life. I mean, there's even been some briefs that go so far as to argue that it's more difficult for them to go and vote. I mean, that they just somehow don't have these capabilities like Caucasians do. So I agree with you. It's condescending. It is a very unfortunate strategy in court. Unfortunately, it's a strategy that is fueled by a whole infrastructure of academics and other, you know, interest groups who you know, have pushed this orthodoxy. So I think it's one that unfortunately works and has a receptive audience. So no, there's no shame or reluctance to employ these tactics, I don't think.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you for your question, Linda. Christian, are there any closing remarks you'd like to make before we finish the call today?
No, thanks for all the questions. Extremely good ones. I in just sitting here, the Senate factors issue, I would just note that, look, Senate factors can be a defendant's friend. A plaintiff can't win on jingles alone. He needs, or she needs, more than just jingles. So don't forget, while the Senate factors are a headache, they can be your friend. So with that, I thank everybody for listening, and thanks for paying attention to these issues.
Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I'd like to thank our speaker for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us today. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.